Mr. Chernovic, hello.
Hi, David. It's Lewis.
Lewis, well, thank you very much for talking with us.
My
pleasure. Really appreciate it. And maybe we should explain for anyone who is not familiar with this, the title. This does indeed refer to the fact that there was a time when you could show two people together on a bed as long as each of them had one foot on the floor, right?
Yeah, well, there had to be one of the people had to have a foot on the
one
floor.
One of them had, oh, okay.
At all times.
At all
times. This was one of the sillier conventions that grew up around the code of conduct that guided TV programming and was based on the older movie code that had been in existence since the 1930s. And in the early days of TV, it really only applied to daytime programming because in prime time, they didn't even approach two people fooling around in a bed together. It was only in the daytime soaps that really became an issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that a little bit. At what point was the first time that people on television would have seen a married couple in bed together, not amorously involved, but simply in bed as if just preparing to go to sleep?
I have debated this endlessly with radio listeners around the country. I am something of an authority on this subject, but TV is such a vast and varied universe that even I'm not positive. Here's my best guess. Mm-hmm. Even though you couldn't see two married people in the same bed in most of the first half of the 1950s on TV, the sitcoms of that period, the Lucys, the Father Knows Best, the shows like that, were predated by a show that was brought over from radio called The Goldbergs, about a New York immigrant family, and I believe that Mr. and Mrs. Goldberg shared the same bed on TV in the late 40s. Now, what makes this interesting is that they weren't a handsome couple, they weren't a young couple, they weren't an athletic-looking couple. They were a couple of doughy-looking immigrant folks who spoke with accents. So I think that's why it was okay.
The book starts really kind of gets started in the decade of the 50s. And what's interesting there is a number of things are interesting there, but particularly how much ground was broken by Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz in their program. And in fact, in terms of television history, in a number of ways they broke ground. They really set the pattern for the style and the method of production that sitcoms would follow forever and still do, really.
The three camera shoot,
right.
Desi Arnaz invention.
The interesting thing was one of the things that they did, though, in terms of content that was really groundbreaking, was that when Lucille Ball got pregnant, she really was pregnant, the network and the sponsors really suggested to her that they hide it.
Oh, they were adamant about it. The sponsor was a tobacco company. I believe it was Philip Morris, but I'm not positive. And they really didn't want a wonderful, healthful product like tobacco associated with a pregnant woman. So they urged her to wear baggy clothes and to allow herself to be photographed behind furniture and poking out from behind plants and so forth. And she would have none of it, to her credit. And so there was a whole series, an arc of episodes, that began with her announcing that she was pregnant, although she was forbidden from using the word pregnant, to when she gave birth on the same day in real life by cesarean section and on her show that night. And the result was the first example of must-see TV in the United States. The whole country came to a stop, turned on the TV, and watched Lucy and Desi run to the hospital and Lucy give birth.
Yeah, and it was tremendously successful for them that people, this here was a real life story that was happening to the couple, and then they were acting out the story that other people had, obviously other people had experienced. I know my own mother has talked about how she was pregnant with me at the same time that Lucy was pregnant, and that I'm sure that for a lot of people, they shared, it was a way of kind of sharing in the experience and all saying that, well, this is something that we all kind of know what this is about.
Was your father part of that generation of returning servicemen from the war who came home and settled down with a family and moved to the suburbs and all that?
Yes, as a matter of fact, he was.
So you fit the demographic.
Yeah.
What was going on? Part of Lucy's genius was that she, in a very funny and surreal way, she reflected what was going on in the United States, and just as your parents were settling down and having children, Lucy and Desi were settling down and having children. This was the start of the baby boom generation, the biggest single generation of children in this country's history, right up to the present generation, which I believe is somewhat bigger, the so-called digital generation. And Lucy knew that showing her pregnant self on TV was simply showing millions of young women that they weren't alone in what they were going through. This was a brilliant realization of hers, and it wasn't the only one. She, years and years before anyone had a color TV set, she was filming her shows in color. Now that's smart.
Yeah, this is one. I think when you look at this subject of dealing with sensitive issues on television, the question that one asks over and over again, and every time there's a change, you ask the same question: is television reflecting a social reality or leading a social reality? And I think in this particular case, it was simply showing what a lot, maybe not all Americans, but it was showing the way that an awful lot of Americans were living. It was simply reflecting the reality of their daily life.
And I do think that there's a good argument to be made that that's how it's been throughout TV history. When TV started to get racier in prime time, really was when all those boomer kids started to get into their teens and 20s. All of a sudden, they weren't interested in the same kind of pap, if you will, that had served when they were children. They wanted to see something that was edgier, and TV responded.
But just to get to underscore sort of the irony about Lucy, I think it's particularly interesting that we knew that she was pregnant. We saw that she was pregnant. We followed this whole story, but no one ever said the word pregnant.
No. She used every imaginable word except pregnant. She talked about being in a family way. She talked about expecting. She even told Ethel in that first episode that she was feeling dauncy. Dauncy was a word, Lucy explained to Ethel, that her mother had used, and it meant that she wasn't feeling well in the morning. And immediately Ethel knows what the implication is. And by extension, immediately the audience knew what the explanation for that word was. But that's quite a stretch.
Yeah. The other maybe important thing to talk about at this point, or something that again offers us some remarkable basis of comparison, was the appearance of Elvis Presley on Ed Sullivan Show, and this controversy about how much of Elvis you got to see.
it just seems so quaint that everyone was upset in the mid-50s about the possibility of corrupting the youth of America by showing Elvis swiveling his hips as he sang rock and roll. Well, we know now that Elvis came upon the whole idea of swiveling his hips because when he started performing, he was so nervous that his leg shook. But in those early TV performances, the producers of the show were apt to order the cameramen, and they were all men in those days, to only show him from the waist up. Well, that was kind of silly. It was like that would be like showing a piano player without ever taking a shot of the fingers on the keyboard. I mean, this was an important part of the act, and it was why all those teenage girls in the audience were screaming and weeping with excitement. It was that sexy performance on stage.
Mm-hmm.
Elvis almost didn't make it on the Ed Sullivan Show at all. Ed was the grand arbiter of the nation's taste in the early days of TV. His variety show was the most popular show on the air for many years. And he was quite capable of ordering a female guest who was wearing a low-cut gown to put the gown on backwards and come out that way if he didn't like it. So he swore that he would never put anyone as tasteless as Elvis Presley on the air. Then Steve Allen, a young comedian and variety show host, was given a show opposite Ed. And everyone thought Ed's going to kill him in the ratings. But for his first show, he had the genius to book Elvis. And lo and behold, he beat the mighty Ed Sullivan in the ratings. Of course, Ed's resolve not to put Elvis on his show melted immediately, and he signed him to a three-show appearance for, I believe, $50,000. Which made him the highest-paid performer in TV.
And eventually, Ed gave him the stamp of approval. At some point, he said, as he did, you know, this is a really fine young man, or some such thing in real true Ed Sullivan style. And I'm sure that was extremely important for Elvis and guaranteed him some wider acceptance to have, as you say, the man who had a lot to do with what people thought about what was entertainment, to have him come along and say, fine, upstanding young man.
Well, he was addressing the parents of America when he said that, and he was giving Elvis his seal of approval. And by all accounts, Elvis was a fine, polite, Southern young man who was very well-mannered and loved his mother and so forth and so on. And I think Ed was responding to that.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Louis Chinovic. He is a novelist. He's also written some nonfiction books. He's also done a lot of TV criticism. He's former television editor of The Hollywood Reporter, former managing editor of On Production magazine. He was also on-air entertainment reporter for Fox Television in Los Angeles. And his book, One Foot on the Floor, The Curious Evolution of Sex on Television from I Love Lucy to South Park, is out now. It's published by TV Books. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Moving up to the 60s, I want to talk about the Jack Parr story, which, again, seems sort of amazing given the kinds of things that even on broadcast television can get by now. In 1962, Jack Parr kind of got in a snit and walked off. He eventually came back, but he walked off because the censors wouldn't let him tell a joke that referred to the WC. And I don't know, now if we could take a poll of how many people listening to us actually know what that means. It refers to the water closet, which is the toilet. And so he wanted to tell this joke, and the censor said, no, you can't say WC. You can't refer to the toilet. And he said, well, if that's the way you're going to be, I quit.
He was a very serious-minded comedian, if you will, and he was, to overuse a word that is very commonplace now, he was edgy. He took his joke-telling and storytelling seriously, and his replacement was a very easygoing, likable young man from the Midwest named Johnny Carson. And Johnny was able to tell jokes and make references on air that Jack would never have been allowed to say. And I believe it was because of his manner that he could get away with these things. And I think that episode Jack Parr walking off over a relatively innocent joke that Johnny Carson could have repeated a few months later without anyone batting an eye over it, illustrates the capricious nature of standards and censorship on television. What was banned on one program could be allowed on the program following on the same network. And in fact, in later in the 1960s, there was a huge furor in TV over the issue of could Barbara Eden show her belly button when she was on I Dream of Jeannie.
Well, that's a great story. The story of Jeannie's navel.
Yes, you know? The great naval war of the late 60s. Well, Barbara Eden was this, and still is, an adorable actress who played a 5,000-year-old genie who is living in a house with an astronaut.
That's high concept for you.
Or as it's called in Hollywood, high con. And the creator of that show was Sidney Sheldon, the novelist. Later to become the novelist, and his books, of course, are kind of racy too. Mm-hmm. But he took the side of the censors, who forbade Jeannie's costume from being low enough to show her navel. The theory was that they were bringing into the homes of America a show in which a single woman was living with a single man. Well, it didn't matter that the single woman was a 5,000-year-old genie. And a single man was a sort of befuddled astronaut. There was no way they were going to allow that. The show that aired immediately after I Dream of Jeannie on the same network was Laugh-In. And every single week, a young actress named Goldie Hawn gyrated, frugged, or whatever the dance was, in a bikini, and America could see her belly button painted with flowers, just by tuning in.
Well, that just doesn't make very much sense. There's no logic to this.
No.
How did that happen? That on these two shows, on the one that people were so adamant that you couldn't see Barbara Eden's navel, but that Goldie Hawn, she was dancing, she was all painted up, but she was wearing a bikini, considerably less than the costume that Barbara Eden wore, and. How is it that we had such radically different sorts of standards there?
Well, one of the points that I keep making in the book is that there is no logic to what happened in the history of censorship on TV, and that's partly caused by the fact that there was so much of it from the very beginning that it was impossible for the censors and the would-be censors to patrol it in any sort of logical way. So things kept slipping by. And censorship also was courtesy of the advertisers in those early days. So different advertisers had different standards. Advertisers in the early days of TV often brought a person onto the studio lot, into the production office, with a red pencil, and that person read the scripts and took out what he found objectionable, and I use he because it was always men in those days, and that varied from person to person. A religious person might find something objectionable, a kind of a prudish person might find some other thing objectionable, and a third person might find none of the things that the first two found objectionable to bother him. So that's how it worked. It was very hit and miss, and it depended very much on the individual circumstances.
How involved today are sponsors in determining program content?
Ah, well, we've come full circle now, almost. They are beginning, and I underline the word beginning, to become involved all over again. I will give you some examples. There's a TV show on in daytime called The View.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I'm blanking on her name.
It's Barbara Walters and a number of other, hosted by four women of sort of different ages.
Well, they made a deal with the Campbell Soup Company to tout it inside the show. So recently there was an episode of the show in which all of the women talked about how wonderful Campbell's soup is, how much they liked it growing up, and then they sang the Campbell soup song. That's one example. Here's another. Just last week, the USA Network canceled plans to do a TV movie about the Tylenol. It was either Tylenol or Excedrin that was tampered with.
It was Tylenol.
Tylenol,
yeah.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. They canceled a plan to do a TV movie about that because of drug company objections.
Huh.
Here's another example. There is coming to the air in the next season a show called The Hooters Show. It is sponsored by the Hooters chain of restaurants. And it will be like some of these sillier game shows on the air now. The prize will be you win a date with a Hooters girl. I could keep going.
That just I'm still sort of stunned about by that one. That this year it's the year 2000, almost 2001. And of course, but I'm stunned that we still have Miss America. So
let me give you the shorthand explanation of why this is happening. TV these days in the 100 channel universe begins to look like another medium with which you're familiar, radio. There are now niche channels that appeal to very specific audiences. They can make money, they can do business by appealing to just teenage boys or just teenage girls, mm-hmm. or just men 50-plus or whichever small fragment of the audience it is. And on these niche channels, advertisers can buy entire blocks of time and put on their own shows if they want. And that, I'm afraid, is what's going to start happening. Ford, for example, is going to sponsor a wilderness trek show that's going to be tied in with its SUVs, you see?
So the vehicle they'll be driving, it will always be a Ford Explorer or something like that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's the new trend in the 100-channel universe, mm-hmm. or the 500-channel universe, or wherever we are these days.
Well, we're a little bit past the midpoint. We have some callers. We will get right to you, I promise, in just a second. Mm-hmm. Just as quickly as I mention again, our guest, Louis Chinovic, is the author of the book One Foot on the Floor, The Curious Evolution of Sex on Television from I Love Lucy to South Park. TV Books is the publisher. Our guest has worked for The Hollywood Reporter. He's also former managing editor of On Production magazine and former on-air entertainment reporter for Fox Television in Los Angeles. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll start in here with a caller in Bloomington, Illinois, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
With the change in the political situation in Washington, do you think there will be a new attempt at censorship?
I do think that what you saw in the recent campaign will continue, which is a very strong campaign to bring back what used to be called the Family Hour. I think that will continue, and it may even be successful under a Bush administration. I believe he's in favor of that. If the Democrats had won, Joe Lieberman, the vice president, the vice presidential candidate for the Democrats, was one of the most outspoken people in the U.S. Congress, calling for a turn away from the coarseness and crassness on TV. He and Senator John McCain, Senator Byrd, and Senator Brownback from Kansas all co-signed a letter to the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission last summer calling for the FCC to uphold its own standards calling for stations to be operated in the public interest. And they maintained that the kind of programming you see on prime time, which offends a minority, a significant minority of the audience, was not in the public interest. They wanted standards back. They wanted the family hour back. They wanted the code of broadcasting to be brought back. The TV world has operated without a code since the mid '80s. So I don't know how much censorship there will be. Whether it will just be self-censorship, the kind of protective self-censorship that Hollywood has always resorted to when politicians have started thumping the podium. But I think something is coming, yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, let's go to Chicago for someone else right here on line one. Hello.
Along the line we were just commenting about, Steve Allen, sometimes known as Mr. Television, was in the process of writing a book just before his unfortunate death.
Mm-hmm.
It was Trash TV and Raunch Radio.
Mm-hmm.
Vulgarians at the Gate, Raising the Standards of Popular Culture, somewhat of the titles they were choosing to call his new book, in which he commented about the coarsening of culture,
mm-hmm,
and values and the tastelessness, and also the other things that we speak of, the violence and bloodshed. And I felt that we ought to become more, at least discriminating in what we're exposing the youth of today, because to the extent that we ourselves show the effects of some of the things, who knows what effects future TV may have on the generations to come. But Steve Allen certainly was in the vanguard of people who were trying to make changes in the tenor and tone of what we see on TV, and although it's hard to put the genie back into the bottle, some things surely can be done. And he wasn't against censorship because, maybe you get to read the book, but I highly recommend a review I just recently have of Steve Allen's work. So thank you very much for what you're doing.
Sure.
Yes. Mr. Allen was a figure that I very much admired. He was in many ways a Renaissance man. He was not only a TV performer, he was an accomplished musician, a songwriter, a novelist, and a very erudite man. He was, to some extent, though, in my opinion, this is just my opinion, captured by the right wing's agenda in his later years. He was a spokesman for a group called the Parents Television Council, and he became their spokesman. And the PTC, the Parents Television Council, is an organization that measures, among other things, it measures the number of bad words and sexual situations and so forth that are on TV in various given periods, and then it issues reports. Recently, the PTC stopped measuring the words hell and the words damn because, according to them, they are now so commonplace in the culture that there's no point in trying to point to them and say, look how bad TV is because these words have been on the air so much in the last 2 weeks. Well, that points to the fact that society does evolve, and what is considered bad at one time may be acceptable at another time. Here's my point. Steve Allen arguably was one of the main factors in beginning the coarsening of television, the coarsening of society, because remember what we discussed earlier. he's the guy who put Elvis Presley on opposite Ed Sullivan. And he did that at a time when lots and lots of people thought that Elvis Presley was doing the devil's work and that it was very bad to show him to the young people of America. Now, Steve Allen lends himself to what really is a right-wing crusade in his last years. And he put on full-page newspaper advertisements in which he said, TV is leading children down a moral sewer. Are you as disgusted, and I'm reading from his advertisement because I've got it right here in front of me. Are you as disgusted as I am at the filth, vulgarity, sex, and violence TV is sending into our homes? Are you fed up with steamy, unmarried sex situations, filthy jokes, perversion, vulgarity, foul language, violence, killings, etc.? Well, here's how you and I can end it. And then there's a coupon that you can clip to send money to the Parents Television Council and be put on their mailing list. Well, look at the list of things that I've just read to you. It not only includes foul language, violence, and killings, but perversion. What do you suppose that means? Sex situations. What do you suppose that means? In many of these cases, those are code words for homosexuality or for sex practices that we don't like. So I think it's something we all have to be very careful about. We have to respect people who don't believe as we do, and we have to protect our children at the same time. That's my rambling answer to your questions.
All right. We are headed into our last 15 minutes of the show. Our lines are full. We'll try to get everyone in, but you can help us by trying to be brief. 333. Well, I don't mean you. I mean the callers. We try to get everybody in. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Our next caller is someone locally, line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
You never did answer whether there were censors or not. Are these networks, do they have any self-proposed agenda? Because it seemed like CBS for a while was trying to do the family type thing for a few years there, but it always made me kind of laugh when they would run Texas Ranger. But they also waited until later in the evening. Mm-hmm. And now it seems like some of the shows are coming on that are a little bit more adult entertainment earlier. And it just doesn't seem like there's any kind of family-type hour or anything like that at all anymore.
Well, there isn't. And you're right about CBS. The networks these days are very different. They skew, to use the advertising term, toward different demographics. The youngest skewing network, I believe, is either the WB or the UPN. And the average age of its viewer is in the 20s.
Yeah.
CBS is the oldest skewing network. The average age of its viewer is in the 50s.
Okay, and I have one more comment, and then I'll let
sure.
you go. Last year, we were a Nielsen family for the sweeps weeks.
Oh, boy.
And it seemed like every show that we watched was, first time somebody got to sleep with somebody.
Yeah.
Almost every show that we seemed to watch. And we put a few comments in there that was really kind of bad, because we also watch TV with our children, and we didn't want to watch half of them because that's the theme through the whole week.
Mm-hmm.
And we wrote that into the Nielsen
good for you.
Rating, and I'm wondering if anybody would hear that, or Nielsen just kind of...
Oh, I think they hear if you were a Nielsen family, they hear you loud and clear, because you know what? The bottom line of TV is the bottom line, and if you didn't like what you were watching, advertisers are going to give you something else. That's how it works.
Do networks still have censors?
They have what's called the Standards and Practices Department, which is the polite way of saying yes, they do.
They do. All right. Let's talk with a caller in Bloomington, Indiana. That's line number four. Hello.
Hi. I know there used to be some prudity on television. I'm not defending that prudity, mm-hmm. but there were some very good reasons for enforcing a standard of decency and not glamorizing indecency, mm-hmm. not glamorizing sex outside of marriage, not glamorizing dishonesty. Mm-hmm. The very good reasons for not glamorizing callousness or a disrespect for social institutions. We have to remember that television and the drama, the movies, are very powerful role models for young people.
Absolutely.
And you can just follow following the statistics to see the disaster that has come about. And I won't blame it all on television, but television was certainly certainly somewhat responsible for the fact that in 1950, mm-hmm. whereas one baby in 25 was born out of wedlock in 1950, one baby in three is born out of wedlock now. And no society has ever survived that kind of an illegitimacy rate. And before indecency became the norm, mm-hmm. There was virtually no venereal disease in the middle class. And now, right as we speak, one in four young people at your local high school, one in four of those young people is infected with a venereal disease. And but that statistic is a couple years old. It may be worse by now. And those young people, if they get cured of the venereal, and some of those venereal diseases are very bad news. Mm-hmm. But if they get cured, most of them will have another venereal disease within 6 months.
May I ask you a question, sir?
Sure.
What do you think about condom advertising on television?
Well, I think condoms probably do more harm than they do good because they give people a false sense of safety. And for instance. Condoms are virtually useless against human papillomavirus.
So you're an abstinence man. That's
yes. There should be abstinence before marriage. Mm-hmm. That was the standard of decency, mm-hmm. and it meant that there were. When I was in school, none of my fellow students, either in grade school or high school, had any worry about the fact that they would that their parents would be divorced, that they would lose their families. Mm-hmm. Now, children outside of families are being born out of wedlock are so common, mm-hmm. that there are some neighborhoods, some inner city neighborhoods especially, where there are no intact families left, mm-hmm. and the tradition of marriage has simply been completely lost. That means a young woman now growing up has no prospect of ever getting married and having a stable home and a husband to support her when she has her children.
I'm going to jump in here just because we have a lot of other callers, and I think we're starting just to drift a little bit. You want to comment at all, Mr. Janovic, on anything the caller said, particularly the relationship between these social issues, which are very real, and television?
Well, let me go back to I would love to comment at length, but let me just tell you a quick story, caller. In the mid-1960s, venereal disease was epidemic. Then, and a TV program called Mr. Novak about a high school teacher wanted to do an episode in which a boy has gonorrhea or syphilis and is distraught and comes to the teacher for help. And the network censors wouldn't allow it on the air, despite protests by the American Medical Association and the Surgeon General of the United States. So, historically, TV has been very timid about addressing these issues and hasn't really been out in front of society at all, on most of these sexual issues.
Let's talk with someone else locally here, line number three. Hello?
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I hope I'm not repeating you because I didn't hit the first part of the program, but mm-hmm. a couple of points. One, about Steve Allen, I think maybe even more poignant than having Elvis Presley on. He had Lenny Bruce on, and I think more than once.
Yeah.
The other point, just very quickly, I think, is that today I think the real pressure for censorship comes from advertisers.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. You're absolutely right about both things, sir. Advertisers become a very they want to use sex to sell, but they also they also don't want to offend the audience. There's a Showtime series that just debuted a couple weeks ago that's very sexual and very controversial. It's called Queer as Folk. It's about gay men in Pittsburgh, and it shows the club scene, and it's very blunt, and it's fairly graphic. At any rate, it's my understanding that a lot of products that are usually associated with a kind of sexy lifestyle would not allow that show to mention the names of the products on air. And we're talking about the high fashion companies that usually use sexy models and so forth. So yes, advertisers are very, very powerful when it comes to dictating content.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Let's go to Peoria here, line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I always enjoyed Pee-wee's Playhouse, and I always kind of thought that it had sort of a gay sensibility. And I'm just wondering if you had any observations on that. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay.
I had the same feeling. I don't know if it's just us, caller, or what, but I, Pee-wee Herman always struck me as being, you know, he'd sort of prance around and he was sort of effete, but he was also very innocent and boyish. So, you know, who knows? We may just be reading too much into it.
All right, let's go to Chicago, line two. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
I go back a little further than your present conversation, going back to radio. Mm-hmm. And I can remember when I was 10, 11 years old, Fred Allen having a running battle with the NBC vice presidents over censorship. And no doubt some of that was sexual, and which I didn't understand at the time, being that young. But I also remember Bob Hope and his broadcast, where he broadcast usually during the war and just before the war, in Army and Marine Corps camps. And his broadcasts were laden with double entendres, and he would have his joke, and they would take him off the air for a couple of seconds, and he would proceed further. And this is all nonsense, and there's more immorality that comes out of the mouths of Supreme Court justices and presidential candidates than comes out of that involves the sexual business.
People who object to the kinds of things that you've just said, when confronted with the choice, they really don't follow the logic of their position, in my opinion. What's the choice between crassness and bad taste and variety in the United States, where we have a free enterprise system, so-called? Who is going to judge what's in good taste? Will we let the politicians? Will we let the Supreme Court justices? How about our ministers? Perhaps we can have Jim Baker and Jimmy Swaggart decide for us. We should also remember that in dictatorships, whether of the right or the left, the very first thing that the dictator does is tell the citizens what they can and cannot see, what they can and cannot read. The price we pay for our freedom to read anything we want is a lot of bad taste. And that's why parents have to be very, very careful about bringing up their children in this rich, yeasty, widely various atmosphere that we live in, because it's all out there and available.
Mm. One more quick question for which there isn't really time. We know that the over-the-air broadcast networks have for some time now been steadily losing audience.
Mm-hmm.
We also know that cable channels have a much different standard, and you can get away with stuff, you can do stuff mm-hmm. that you can on HBO, on Comedy Central, that you cannot do on the over-the-air networks. I wonder, though, to what extent the fact that the broadcast networks have to compete with the cable channels leads them to, in effect, loosen their standards to the extent that they can.
Oh, I, It absolutely does. They not only have to compete with cable, they can show and say anything because they don't have to worry about advertisers, but the traditional three networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC, have to compete with Fox. They have to compete with UPN and the WB, all of which are taking their most advertiser-desirable segments of the audience away. We live in a world where advertisers would rather reach a smaller audience of young people than a larger audience of old people. So that if you have a show on CBS and it's number one in the time period, but all the people who are watching are over 50, it may not be as profitable as the second and third rated show in the same time period, which is reaching a smaller audience, but it's all kids.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to stop there because we've just used our time. I want to say to you, thanks very much for talking with us.
It's been my great pleasure.
Our guest, Louis Chernovic, and if you'd like to read his book, it's titled One Foot on the Floor, The Curious Evolution of Sex on Television from I Love Lucy to South Park.